Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Kevin Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spring from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another edition of Not the Footy Show. It's our 497th show.
Woohoo!
So we're getting very, very close to the 500 mark, and we are asking for your suggestions who you'd like to hear on that 500th show. So just message us. We've had a few suggestions. Roger Federer, Nick Kyrgios was one, and Vitali Klitschko was another one.
Vitali!
Yeah, so I have actually tried to get in touch with Federer and Klitschko, so we'll wait and see if we hear back from them.
That'll be good.
But as usual, we promise we've got a really good show ahead of you. Today we're going to be focusing on culture in sports. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a sec, but I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And John, yeah, talking about that, you and I have had this discussion. What is culture? How do you get culture? Does it grow in the back of your fridge?
Grows, a lot of it grows in the back of my fridge, Ashley. I don't know, it's obviously a bit of a joke, but that, ha ha ha. It's the one of the key buzzwords of sport in the modern era, isn't it? Culture.
It is indeed. Well, we're going to be catching up with Brian Fitzpatrick, who has a company called Headspace Coaching. He's been apparently friends with Colin Batch, the coach of the Kookaburras, for a long time, and he calls himself an emotional intelligence coach and has been working with Colin Batch to basically carry the baton on, a bit like the All Blacks, to make sure that the Kookaburras continue that successful history that they've had over a number of years and how they get the players to buy into it. I think it's a fascinating interview, not just for anyone who likes sport. For me, it was really interesting from even a business perspective as to how you get the right culture in your office space.
Do we start, though?
Just, hey?
What are we going to start with?
Well, just before we do, I just want to say last show we had Fiona Crawford on,
yep,
and she brought out the book Never Say Die, The 100-Year Overnight Success of the Australian Women's Football. That book is now out, so you can get it for someone for Christmas. I have a copy already. It looks fantastic. I haven't managed to read it yet, but it is out, and we thank Fiona for her time last week. But we're going to touch on first up the ABC and how they made the announcement that they weren't going to cover the Olympic Games. Now, a lot of people got up in arms, and I thought it was quite interesting, John, in that, as we all know, the ABC has had government cost cuts, and that's hard to say, isn't it? Anyway, but they've had their budget cut drastically by the government, and people are up in arms, whereas Ida Buttrose has said, well, we've got to be responsible here and look at what we can deliver within that budget. Now, what do they want to have? Do they want people to lose their jobs, but we give the Olympics? Or do they want us to keep people employed at the ABC? So there's obviously a balancing act between that, because it's a lot of money. They're talking about $1 million, I think it was, for the rights for, you know, the Olympic Games.
That's just the rights.
Exactly. That's not then the cost of having people there, having the satellite, all of those sort of things to then feed it back into Australia. And then presumably they've got the commentators, but then they've got to obviously fly them up there, accommodate them. Then they've probably got to find experts to go alongside those commentators. So it is a much, much bigger task. And as they've said quite clearly, the management of the ABC, there are now so many other options. People can get free coverage on their phones. And they found that the audience had dropped at the last Olympic Games. And so they made a business decision. I personally think they've made the right decision, and I think even if they've made the decision to maneuver for the government to give them more money, so that if the government turns around and goes, no, no, we want the ABC, well, the ABC can say, well, you give us the money and we'll do it.
I suppose a lot of it comes down to what we expect of the ABC, and how, as you say, how much money we're prepared to give them as a community to ensure that we get what we want from the ABC. And we, through our elected officials, have made it clear to the ABC that they've got to cut costs. I mean, that's just the reality and nature of it all. If we as a community don't want the ABC to cut costs and keep providing the services that they do, then we should be lobbying our elected officials to make sure that they give the ABC the due funding through the processes that exist.
Well, look, I think you and I, we both love sport.
Yep.
I think the ABC is actually one of the best broadcasters of sport in the country.
Yep.
I enjoy listening to them when they do broadcast things, especially the cricket. But then you have to look at the reality, John. And I'll give you an example. And this was a conversation I had with somebody from the ABC, was when they were doing the Sheffield Shield, we'll call it that. I don't even know what it's called now with in terms of sponsorship. But they were saying when they were broadcasting that and they would give away their everyday programming to cross to the Sheffield Shield, they would lose regular listeners. And the new listeners that they would get from the sporting public like myself were pretty much on a par. So they're going, well, is it really a gain for them to be able to do that? Now, if you look again, this is a station that cannot go out and sell advertising and cannot get a commercial gain from covering those events.
And I think we've got to look at this as well beyond just this, what we see in cities. I mean, the ABC is there as much for every person in the country as well.
And that's throughout very the land. Important for them. Yeah.
It's very important. Yeah, it is. It's very important for the people that live in those areas that the ABC is covering the sorts of things they are. Now, that would, you would think, is an argument for them doing an Olympic coverage, because very often people in the areas that can get the ABC can't get a lot of other services, and that includes internet services and all of those sort of streaming things that we take for granted here in the city. So I think there is an argument for the ABC to be broadcasting it. Whether or not that argument can be justified and held up against the commercial costs of doing that, I mean, are there any commercial radio stations that are picking up the rights?
Yeah, I mean, that would be interesting, and the ABC could possibly do a deal with them to put that into the country areas, because as we know, when you listen in the city, they now go, we're leaving our country listeners now because of da-da-da. So they could feed it into the country areas and take a feed specifically, say, from Macquarie or somebody like that, and push it into those country areas and still satisfy that market.
I mean, a lot of the idea of the ABC charter is to provide room for content and opinions and whatever else that don't get a run through other channels of media. Niche programming, if you'd like. SBS is for a long time, ABC's been more moving into more commercial type programming, and not that they can, but they are. And the SBS has been the one doing the niche sports, so to speak. Is the Olympic Games now a niche sport? I mean, if there's no one else covering it on radio, if all the commercials are staying away from it, maybe there is an argument that ABC do it to provide the coverage to communities that don't have the ability to watch Channel 7. Are they the broadcaster this year?
I would think so. I don't honestly know. But again, to me, it throws up another argument. Is are the IOC or whoever is in charge of the rights asking too much for these rights? Now, you know, I work in the television space, and talking to a lot of the TV stations that I've worked for as a freelancer, they're saying what they've been asked to pay for the Olympics is ridiculous. They said it is just too much, and that the incremental rise since London 2012 to Tokyo 2020 is just ridiculous and almost beyond what their budgets can actually cope with. So there's an issue there. And I'm going to throw another one at you. It was interesting, one of the articles, funnily enough, it was saying that if they don't do the Olympics, the ABC will lose a lot of their sports broadcasters because, and quote unquote, the games are considered a highlight of the sporting calendar for these broadcasters. Now, again, to
what,
me...
What?
Yeah, so...
Run that past me again?
So they feel that they will lose a lot of their broadcasters because the broadcasters are only there for the Olympic Games trip every 4 years.
Oh, you mean the people, the physical broadcast staff.
Exactly. And so if the ABC is not going to do it, they're going to lose all these people.
Where are they going to go?
Well, that's the thing. The only place they can go is TV, some of them probably.
There's only so many jobs going around, folks.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. I mean... It's,
but then if that, my argument for that is if you are there purely on the hope of going to an Olympic Games every 4 years, then you're there for the wrong reasons. That's my honest opinion. Because if you are there as a broadcaster of sport, surely that's what you love. You're doing it week in, week out. You know, if the ABC picked me up and said, Ashley, we want you to now be a part of our team full time, I would probably go, yeah, love it.
Well, if that is the reason you're there and you're going to leave because of it, well, there's plenty of other people that will be sticking their hand up for your job at the ABC.
Exactly.
And the reasons you work at the ABC, I would have thought, are not because you're going to the Olympics every 4 years.
Yeah, I found that a bit of a hard sort of comment to back up or believe.
Yeah, and look, it's easy to understand why people in that space might be a bit cheesed off that the ABC is not going to do it. But was that actually promised in any of their contracts? Is that a contractual obligation the ABC actually have and they've got to work through now? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, there may well be. That may have been the carrot to get a few staff on, involved that, you know, come across to the ABC and we will give you the Olympics. You
yeah.
know?
Oh, I'm sure it's spoken about. Maybe not written down in a contract, though.
Yeah, well, we would only find that out between the ABC and those contracted.
Will it make a difference? Will it make a difference to the sports that are going that need that coverage for that 2 week period?
But that's a very interesting question because I thought about this and I thought, do you know what? I don't think it will in terms of that. If the ABC choose to do the things that I thought made them special during the Olympics, which were the little interviews that they do with people, the backstories that they always had supporting the events that they covered. To me, that was what made them special. That was the part that was really interesting because you can get the 100 meters, you know, anywhere. You can watch that or hear it or anywhere you want because it's a blue ribbon event. But it was the little stories that they would find, that they would do their research, that they would do interviews leading up to the games. If they continue to do those, I think they can still capture a big part of the Olympic market.
Be interesting to see how it plays out, whether at the last minute we do get an announcement from the Scott Morrison standing up there. Oh, look, we found this money. We're going to send the ABC. Let's go.
Well, how many votes will that win him at the next election?
Oh, dude, it might just be enough. It might just be enough.
Hi, I'm Chris Sorello from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, we've talked on this show for a number of years and we've been on air for 14 years about culture in team sports. John and I will have to put our hands up and say we're not quite sure we ever really understood what it was, but I thought it was time that we tried to get our head around it. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, I've caught up with Brian Fitzpatrick, who is an emotional intelligence coach working with the Australian Kookaburras, the Australian hockey team, to try and make sure that they can continue to get the success that they've had over the last 20 years and make sure that the culture is right for the team to achieve all the goals that it sets out. Brian Fitzpatrick, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ash. It's a real pleasure to be with you to share some of the things we do with the Kookaburras.
Now, look, it's fantastic for you to give up your time, and obviously I know you're not going to give away a lot of trade secrets, but what we were hoping you could do is maybe give us an insight, you know, into this word culture, because we hear it so much as sports fans. And I suppose the first question is, how do you determine the culture that exists in a team when you walk into it?
Sure. Ash, I spent a lot of time coaching hockey, so I coached at, you know, national and junior international level and so on. But what I got interested in really was much more about how communities and groups of people work than I did around how the tactics and the techniques and the skills work. So for me, it's an absolute joy and, you know, I get really curious to see about some of the things that we can do in terms of getting people to work together. So culture really is an overused term, but for us, it simply means this, how we do things. Culture is, I think, pretty simply put into four words. It's what we encourage, what we discourage, what we tolerate, and what we ignore. So when we get a group of people together, and it doesn't matter whether it's in business, I work in a lot of business groups helping people build their culture within their corporate world, but when we get a group of people together, a culture will develop whether you want it to or not. You've seen, I think, in the past, some cultures around football clubs and different groups that aren't good. We've looked at the Australian cricket team and saw a culture that, you know, got them into trouble. So we're very, very conscious at Hockey Australia and with the Kookaburras particularly is my brief. Now, there's a saying that says that culture versus the individual, culture always wins. So if we've got a really good culture and a deadbeat turns up, for want of another word, they will either do one of two things. They will either lift their standards or they will leave. And similarly, if we've got a lousy culture, the same thing happens. Good people either drop their standards or they leave. We're conscious of culture being a daily choice. So for us, it's a critical part of our of the way we look at players, the way we select players. We want people that fit our culture. If they don't fit, then I guess no matter how good they are, we'll give them a chance to improve their performance around culture. But if they don't fit, they don't fit. And culture also is built around language. So we want to have some particular language around our group that is special to us, and the way that we engage with each other is built on this sense of what can I contribute rather than what can I get. Does that make sense to you, that bit?
No, it does indeed. And I mean, just to one thing you said there, that you're looking at the people to bring into that group of people, that they've got the right culture. Does that mean that, you know, away from the field, you're looking at their behavior, say on social media or whatever, the type of person they are, as, you know, irrespective of the type of player they are?
Absolutely. What we want to be able to do is, we have a thing called VAA, which is Visiting Athlete Agreement. So it's all of the young men that are coming through the ranks that we think may be future Kookaburras. We want to get them involved in our sessions, and we want to get them to understand what being a Kookaburra really means. So I'll do sessions with the Australian under 21 team and some of the development athletes as well, to make sure that they understand that what they're signing up for when they join the national team, when they're selected for that, that they've got those qualities and they understand that there's some standards set, and we're not negotiating on those standards.
The All Blacks, you know, is another team that is supposed to have this great culture, and they almost have, I believe they have a little book that they give every player that comes into the team. Do the Kookaburras have something similar?
We have a lot of different things. There is an induction book that is being put out, and it's being driven by one of our players, Jake Harvey, who's chosen that. Now, just so that you understand how we get this, when we started, and Colin Batch and I go back a long way, but Colin is the real driver of this, and he trusts me as his trusted advisor to help create and implement that. But what we need to do when we try to determine what culture we want to have a look at what exists currently, yeah. And then what we want to go have a look and go is, now, is that still relevant? Will it still suit us? Mm-hmm. And then there are a number of social factors in play as well. So yes, we're very, very conscious of the use of social media and so on. Understand this, Ash, that within a year or two, we'll have players that were born this century. So the culture that we used through the 70s and 80s when we were playing is no longer relevant. Now, if we try to hold on to an old man's culture in a young man's world, it's not going to work. But that doesn't mean that we don't have, you know, spirited young men who want to have something to believe in. And that's our job, I think, is to get them to be inspired by the vision of what we try to do. So one of the things that we've done is that we've started with what is our quest. And our quest in the Kookaburras is to be truly the world's best hockey team. Now, that creates already a culture of ambition. Yeah?
Yep.
So we don't want to have a group of people that just want to make up the numbers, or just think that, a bronze medal somewhere along the line is a pretty good achievement. No, we want to win. And we want to win as many things as we possibly can. We want to win the big things. So our quest is to be truly the world's best hockey team. Now, right now, I would say, and you know enough about hockey to know, that the best hockey team in the world is the Dutch women's team. But we're on our quest to move towards that. And then in business, as in pretty much anything, one of the biggest YouTube clips watched in the world is by a guy called Simon Sinek. which is called Start With Why. So we've started with why. Why does this group of kookaburras exist, and what is our big why? And we've come up with this, and this has been talked through and worked out with the players. But this is the way it looks, and it says our why is to honour the past and inspire the future through our love of hockey. So that means that we want to be able to go back and talk to ex-Kookaburras, find out about their world, find out about how things were. We want to bring them into our group and create a wider group than just the 27 players and half a dozen coaches that we have. And also we want to make kids feel special. We want them to love the game as much as we do. So it's a conscious effort by our players to go out there and to look after some kids. And we do that through coaching programs. That's a cultural statement in itself. So to honour the past and inspire the future through our love of hockey.
I mean, obviously we're talking about an elite team at the moment, but I'm just thinking if you're a coach of a non-elite side, is it the players that will influence the culture, so the squad of players that you have, or can a coach actually influence it, or is it a combination of the two?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. The coach definitely has a big input upon this, as do the senior players and the other people around the group. Colin Batch, who is our coach, trusts me as the high-performance culture coach. So he actually says, that's your portfolio, go and build that for us. And I do that with the players. So we want to make sure that things are fun when we work. But if you can think about these three points here of find it, be it, coach it. Now, that means that we need to find out what sort of culture we want to have. And then we need to show up that way every day, not just the coaches, but each player. And then we need to coach it. And that just doesn't mean from the nominated coaches, but the players need to coach each other in our culture. So that's done on the field. It's done all over the place. And, you know, when by no means are we, you know, a group of saints. We actually, as I said, are a group of spirited young men who are out there living lives, you know, but competing at the highest level. Now, in your club coaches, of course you can build a culture. You just have to decide what that is. And remember, the culture is what you encourage, discourage, tolerate and ignore. So in my local club where I play, my grandson plays in the under-16s, and there was a parent who was abusing the opposition in a semi-final, and that person was sanctioned by our club executive because it wasn't within the culture that we want. So we have to stand up for it. Yeah. Culture is something that you need to fight for every day.
I mean, you're mentioning again that there are obviously players coming into the Kookaburra setup. They've come through the development squad. We hear a lot about development pathways today. I mean, are those sort of cultural tolerances and aspects, I suppose, and standards even in place, do you think, in a lot of the pathway development? Because to me, sometimes, again, you have that parent that is pushing the child to fulfill their dreams. And sometimes, to me, we see, I've personally seen cultural issues that I think are really bad at that level.
Sure. Our relationship is with the athlete, not with the parent. Now, you know, and that's because we're at an elite level. So one of the things that we're very, very conscious about, and sometimes, you know, we can as sports organisations, NSOs, be, you know, perhaps made guilty for the fact that somebody didn't reach their dreams. So for us, part of the culture is around honesty. Honesty and transparency and vulnerability. So, you know, we give our players regular feedback. And when I say regular feedback, it's important that they have the one-on-ones with the coaches or with me. Secondly, we give them balanced feedback, and that is we don't tell them how wonderful they are all the time. We actually ground them in the fact that there are some areas that they need to develop. And so they're consciously and constantly you know, given feedback about what's going well for them, but also the areas of improvement. Some areas of improvement are actually off field. But for us, one of the things that I think happens, Ash, is if you think that I am just my sport, so for the Kookaburras, we have a conscious effort to go, I'm more than just my sport. So we want to have our players to have rich, multidimensional lives. So that's a really important thing. So none of our players are full-time. They're all working or they are studying. Yeah.
Yep.
We have a thing called the third place. And the third place is somewhere where they can go to get away from hockey and to get away from anything else. So it's the place where you go to regenerate your soul and your spirit. Coaches, that's part of our language. So coaches go to their third place. Athletes go to the third place, and that means they need to go and get away from their sport and away from the pressure of everything and just allow themselves to be and bring themselves back to being centered and grounded and, you know, and let their souls and their spirit get a little bit tickled as well. So that idea that I'm much more than just my sport. The other thing that we are very, very we talk about a lot is that none of these players are making sacrifices. They are not sacrificing a career to be a Kookaburra. What they're doing is making a choice, a free choice, to in this part of their life to devote to hockey. And that makes such a difference, you know, as opposed to them thinking that they have to do it. No, you don't have to do it. You don't have to be here. If you want to be here, this is the set of agreements that we work by.
No, that's fantastic, because I think that to me is a really big one, because then when you have this sort of expectation, then there's this sense of entitlement as well. And if you do away with that, then you can build very positive things.
Sure. And all of the, you know, we want people set up for life. What we have done in terms of trying to get, but getting everybody on board, we have a lot of open communication workshops where people have to be vulnerable in the space. You know, we do a little thing before games in the first couple of years that Colin was involved, where we would do a history project. So, for instance, the players from New South Wales would do a 5 or 7 minute talk or video presentation about an ex-Kookaburra from New South Wales. Yeah, because we want to honour the past. We want to know our history. It's important that our players know the history. So that's been a critical one. And for instance, New South Wales have done the great fullback, Kenny Walk. So those history projects have been there. We invite the past Kookaburras into the change rooms to sing the victory song, to be part of things. That's critical. We have a group called the Rookaburras, which is the players that are there for the first 1, 2, or 3 years. And each Tuesday, they sit down with one of Australia's greats, Rob Hammond, who's our assistant coach, and they look at past historical games to find out about how the Kookaburras got to be where they are today. So we have a sense of our place in history. Another thing that I think is really important is that lately we've been gaining our inspiration before games from within. So we do a little exercise called the Four H's, where a player will stand up and in an absolutely open and vulnerable space, we'll talk about we call them the four H's, but what's been the highlight of their career so far? What's been the hardship? Who's been their hero and what are their hopes for the future? And some of those are about, life. You know, some people will say my hardship might have been, when I had the long-term injury. Somebody else said, my brother died, and opened up to the group about that. And what we do through these things is we shift our team from a place of working in fear to a place of working in love. And I don't mean, you know, in that fluffy love thing, but we love each other, and we love each other enough to, you know, one of the sayings we have is, I care about you enough to tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. And that is a cultural statement in itself. That's the open and honesty that we have. So those are some of the things that, you know, we're doing. And the players actually are very, very proud. I might just touch on a bit of leadership, because leadership is a critical factor in this, and it can't just be led by the off-field staff. So I want everybody in our team to develop leadership. Previously we've had, a leadership group, as a lot of sporting teams do, where there's four or five, you know, players. Now, we vote openly for that, and the guys have to walk up and put their votes on the whiteboard. But still, generally, what happens is that they pick the five people with the most number of caps. So we've actually found that we didn't get a great deal of leadership from those people. We did set up some mentors, and I have to mention these people because they mentored our leaders through to the Commonwealth Games. Mal Meninga, Tim Horan, Liz Ellis, Rochelle Hawkes, Andrew Gaze, Cameron Ling. I rang them and said, you don't know me and I've got no budget, but would you mentor somebody around sporting leadership? And they all just said, yeah, love to do it. And our leaders got a lot of personal growth out of that. But we actually looked at our leadership model then and went, okay, so how do we roll this into our culture? So now what we have, Ash, is about 20 functional leadership roles that people have. So I'll give you, for instance, it might be shootouts. So attacking shootouts. So we're away at the Pro League in Europe, and two of the players that were responsible for that portfolio were not chosen for that tour. But every day when we were going to play a team, there was a set of video clips and a page of notes about how to beat that goalkeeper in a shootout. That, to me, says that we've got a culture where people want to contribute even if they're not there on that day.
That's fantastic. That is absolutely amazing. Now, I mean, we could probably talk on for a lot longer, but we've got a limited time on this podcast. But one thing I find really interesting is you're touching on, obviously, the historical side of things. I love my sport. I love the history of sport, and I think the history is very, very important. Do you think it's helped establish this culture that you've got at the Kookaburras because in that history the Kookaburras have had a run of success, or is that really irrelevant, or is that a result of the culture that's gone before?
Well, if we were an emerging group, I would say that you may not have a great rich history that we have, but we have it, and so why don't we use that to help, you know? And I want you know, I want the players to understand their place in history and that they have a legacy. And I think that's a key ingredient to things, because that way we can't be frivolous with our national selection, and we can't let people off when they don't perform to our cultural standards. The other thing I think too, just noticing that, you know, the All Blacks have a saying that says, you know, better people make better All Blacks. Well, we've pretty much got the same sort of thing, you know. So that to us is important, and understanding that they are, you know, they are a person before they're an athlete. So we work with them. I will often ring and talk about things that are going on in their life other than hockey. And, you know, I think that's a great support that they have as I help them, as I said, develop rich, multidimensional lives, so it's not just all based on hockey.
Well, Brian, it's been fantastic catching up with you and getting an insight as to a little bit about what culture is, and certainly the culture that's around the Kookaburras. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Ash. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mark Aduka, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Oh, that was Brian Fitzpatrick, as I mentioned, who is an emotional intelligence coach coming from a company called Headspace Coaching. And John, I found that really, really fascinating. It was great to get an insight as to what the Kookaburras are doing. One of the bits I found really interesting was that he said how when they're selecting players to come into the program, it's not all about your ability as a player, that there's so many other things that Colin Batch, Rob Hammond and Anthony Potter take into consideration in terms of they try to look at you as a person off the pitch, how you're reacting after a game, all of those things to see if you might be the right personality to fit the, you know, to fit the team and the ethos of the team.
It's interesting, isn't it, how the way these and the ideas behind selecting teams like that have changed. And I suppose in the old days when you had, you know, they'd play a national carnival and then they'd pick the Australian team and they'd go through it. And I'm sure there was a bit of word of mouth about character, but generally you know, if you're a good enough player, you're going to get picked. And they probably had to put up with different bits and pieces from different players over the years and all that. And now, just the nature of it changing. And now these guys are in full-time programs. I mean, when Colin Batch talks about choosing the team, he's choosing a team of 16 or 18 from a pool of 32 or 36, that have been together as a group for a quite a long period of time. So it's an interesting dynamic that they're working within. And that's a culture when they talk about, you know, creating cultures and that. It's not just the culture within that little selected group for that particular tournament. It's a culture across a far wider group that you're hoping seeps down even further so that people move, when they move into that culture, they've already got a little bit of a taste of it, or they've got an idea of it, or...
And I think it's really important, and it's really interesting to hear how the players now buy into it, that they set the standards, that they are the ones who are driving a lot of this. It actually, while I was talking to Brian, it reminded me of many years ago when I was playing football, and we had a fairly successful team, and we had this one player that came into what was a fairly established team, and we were always expected to be there to watch the reserves play, and this one player would never turn up to watch the reserves play, and he would then turn up as we were all in the changes. He was always late every week, lived closest to the ground, and the coach would always pick him. And then in the end, a lot of the players, we were getting upset about it, saying, hang on a sec, we're all here. This is the one guy is not towing the line, and he's not part of the team. And the coach was stunned that we had this reaction, because he was a good player. There was no doubt about it. And then eventually, you know, he was dropped. And the player himself was stunned, like, why have I been dropped? But it was the collective that actually said, look, we don't want him if he's going to be like that. And so I think even that, without knowing it at the time, we had a culture in that team, and this guy was going against that culture. And it was the majority ruled. So, yeah, I found it really interesting talking to Brian, how sometimes there are probably teams that do have cultures without knowing it. And, I mean, the other thing I asked him at the end there was, being a successful team like the Kookaburras, is it easier to have, you know, that culture, or is it harder? Because I'm sure there'll be some people listening going, well, that's all very well because they've had success. The All Blacks have all this success. But I think maintaining that culture and carrying that baton on, the pressure almost becomes greater.
Oh, yeah. And I think we're often talk about these things as how they apply at the elite level, whereas, you know, it goes a lot further and deeper than that. Down through grades, and you can have teams that have different cultures playing in the lowest grade, and the team with the, what we might term the better culture, will be the one that wins, regardless of how good players necessarily happen to be. And especially team sports, where it is all about the way that the team works together more than the individual skills of those involved. Cricket being a bit of an outlier there, it is very much about the skills of individuals.
But you still need to be pretty tight unit as a team if you play cricket. And you know, I played a lot of it. Yeah. And it was, you're still a major cog within a team environment.
Yeah, that's right. But there's, you know, it's a never-ending discussion. It, quite honestly, because culture is going to change too as society's norms change. You know, things that would have been called part of a good culture 30 years ago aren't looked upon in the same way now, are they? The way sport has changed since we first became old enough to play at senior level to what it is now is completely different in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, if you want an example of that, Sir Stanley Matthews, the footballer who, you know, finished at the age of 50, he actually used to do a warm-up and a warm-down, which back in the era that he was playing, the 1950s, most of the guys, as they came off, lit up
a bag
and had a can of beer in the changing rooms, you know, while he was warming down. So, again, he was ahead of his time, and he copped a bit of flack for that, but obviously was a strong enough personality that he was like, well, yeah, you can say that, but I want to keep playing, and I'm going to do this, and it works for me.
Well, I bet more people know Stanley Matthews' name than know the names of the critics of him.
Yep, probably very, very true. But we should probably get moving because it's time for your point.
Recently, cricket, mental health and the wider implications. Because on this podcast over a long time, you've talked about cricket specifically and the challenges and the incidence of people suffering from mental health problems and the suicide rate amongst professional cricketers over traditionally for a long, long time has been higher than it has been for other sports people or even at the outside community. Recently, we've seen a spate of people withdrawing from the Australian national team duties due to what are described as, inverted commas, mental health problems. Now, we don't know exactly what these problems are. Mental health problems are now a huge bubble comes underneath that little quotation mark. Perhaps, first of all, run through your theories again.
It's not my theories, but what I was going to say was there's a fantastic book by David Frith called Silence of the Heart, which deals with that, because in every country where test cricket is played, the suicide rate of ex-cricketers is higher than the national average. Now, he explores in that book why this might be the case. And one of the theories was it because, you know, cricketers get involved in the game so young, it's a very, you know, you can play a lot longer than some other careers. And so then when you come out, you have absolutely nothing to go to, in that very few, I think it's got better now. Cricketers actually study while they're, you know, in the pavilion and not batting or waiting to go into bat, because now, of course, again, part of the culture is you can't be reading a book. You've got to be watching what's going on in the pitch, or you're not a team man. So again, there's that whole thing comes in. But the other thing they were looking at was, you know, when you come to the end of your career, there's only so many coaching jobs, so many commentary jobs. So what do these players do? Or after dinner speakers, there's a limit to how many of those, and also how many times you can tell the same story and get paid for it. So there was that side of things as well. And then it looks at as well in the book, is it because cricket, you play a long time every day? You know, you're playing for sort of 6 hours a day. So you're in this team environment, it's a pretty closeted sort of environment. And you're pretty close to all those guys, you're with them, you spent a lot of time, and then suddenly when it comes to an end, you're on your own. And how do you cope? But yeah, it's a really interesting...
What's interesting I find there is we're talking about people that have come to the end of their careers. And that I imagine happens across all sports. What we seem to be seeing in cricket is people in their careers making these decisions to take time away. Are we asking too much of our professional athletes?
I think there is. It's again, there's, you always feel using the word pressure when it comes to cricket. You shouldn't do it because of the Keith Miller quote, you know.
Pressure
is when you've got a Messerschmitt up your ass.
And that's that's a very valid point. From someone from Keith Miller's perspective, mate, you're out there having a game of cricket. And has sport got too serious?
I think it has. I think that,
have we taken it too far?
I think we have, because we're not seeing the characters that we used to see, because they're not allowed to be characters, because they have to take it serious. Now, you take a player like Derek Randall, who took his cricket incredibly serious and got very stressed out before he went out to bat. That's why he was fidgeting. If you talk to anyone that played with him in the dressing room, he drove them mad because he couldn't sit down. He was wandering around. He'd be yabbering away.
The original Brad Hogg.
Yeah, but he was like that. But he took it very seriously, but he was still able to enjoy it. And I mean, to me, he was the embodiment of enjoyment out on the pitch. When he took a catch, he loved it.
Yeah.
He celebrated it. And we don't see that quite in the same way today. It's much more reserved, controlled. And yeah, but I do think there's too much pressure on the players. I think that they're not given that freedom. The West Indies is a prime example. When Roy Fredericks retired and Desmond Haynes came into the team, he was told, as an opening batsman, you've got the whole series. We think you're the best partnership for Gordon Greenidge. Doesn't matter if you get four ducks, you're in. And I think we need to see more of that. And I think the press need to stop speculating, or the selectors and the coach need to say, hey, he's in for the series. Kill that conjecture as to whether if he fails in two innings, he's out. Give the players maybe a little bit more support. Then you can also look at, well, is there now more sledging, or has the sledging become more personal than it was in years gone by, when it tended to be a little bit more witty? And I think that is an issue as well. I think there's been some pretty nasty things said in the past 20 years out on the pitch.
And I'd like to know if it's even possible, about the impact of things like social media.
It has to have had an impact.
Yeah, and it worries me that we as a society place that much pressure on people who are essentially playing a game. I mean, I see people getting upset about their team's football result or something like that, and I wonder, it worries me that people's sense of self-worth is so entrenched into the performances of people they don't know that it skewed our whole society's view of what sport is really about. And it's not about your right to get up and abuse someone for not doing, it's sport, mate. It happens. It's not like they sat a mass test. 2 + 2 = 4. Bang. Why did you write 3? You're an idiot. It's not like that. It's such a fluid, dynamic thing that's happening that has no right and has no wrong. If you understand, you know, you make a mistake, you get up and you go back and you have another crack at it. That's what it's about. It's not, you made a mistake. We're just going to pound you and pound you for that one single mistake.
Well, yeah, I think the point you got to say there, John, as well is, and you know, I've been advocating this for a long time. If I was running a sporting club, without a word of a doubt, I would ban the players from being on Twitter and certain social media outlets. And I would just say, while you're playing for us, that's part of your contract. If you don't want to play for us, then that's fine. But we're doing this to protect you. Because I think not only do they then, a lot of players get caught up in an argument with a fan who makes some comment, but also some of them do read it and it hurts them. It cuts them to the quick when they read the criticism. Yeah. I mean, it's just not worth reading it, but most people don't have the strength of character to go, do you know what? I'm not going to read it. And if they say anything bad, I don't really care.
Well, that would be a very hard thing to do. Let's face it. We're talking about something that's publicly accessible by everybody that without that sort of behavior going on is a really good way to communicate with friends and family. And so there's, you know, you might be sitting there thinking, well, I use Facebook or Twitter. I use the messenger service because I use it to speak to so-and-so and say, oh, yeah, I'll keep it going or whatever. I don't know. It's such a big, wide-ranging subject. And it's interesting, too, that it seems to hit some sports more than others. And is it just the higher-profile sports that we're seeing this happen in? In this country, it has been cricketers and football players.
And that's the code we don't talk about on the show.
They're the two groups that seem to be having the most difficulty with these areas at the moment. And they would also be the two sports that are most commented about on social media.
Yeah, I think with that, and they are the two.
In this country.
I would say they're the national sports of this country. So there is far more focus on them. And that goes on to your point of the pressure and all of that. But we are now putting so much emphasis on certain games in other sports. You know, you take the Olympic qualifiers. You know, you build it up because of that drama in the sport you love, hockey. And so, yes, the games were fantastic. There was drama and la, 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 la. But we put so much emphasis on to get to the Olympics is the pinnacle. So these games are crucial. And then when there was a mistake or there was an interpretation that some people didn't agree with, it got really nasty and it got beyond respectability, in my opinion.
Look, I'm all for having a crack at the umpire when you're on the field, actually.
Yeah, and then you buy them a beer in the bar afterwards.
That's exactly right. Once the game's over and the final whistle's gone, you're walking off, there's bugger all you can do about it. It's going to be in the paper Monday morning and that's it.
It is true.
And the modern way seems to pillory and hold people accountable for sometimes years afterwards. It's incredible. I mean, what happened after the Ireland Canada game was from some people was disgraceful. And you know what? Ultimately, there's been very, very, very few situations across the history of sport where an umpire has truly lost a team or an individual a victory. So few, I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Yeah, because you've got to look at it in the context of the game.
Exactly.
In that you create other opportunities, there are other incidents in the game that basically you squandered or you made a mistake defensively and allowed the other team in.
And once you go to a point, the first point in the game you can come to and say, oh, that should have been this. Everything that, okay, so let's say that was given as a free hit there. Everything that happens after that is wiped off the board. So you can't say, oh, we should have scored a goal there in the 14th minute and that would have made the score at the end 3-3 because there's no way you can tell what would have happened after that goal if that goal had gone in. Everything's wiped. It's a whole new set of circumstances. Things can change totally differently than what actually ended up playing out.
But it's funny because you talk about that, John, and a sport we don't touch on too often, but it's never really talked about, is boxing referees. Now, there have been boxing referees who only the really sort of big followers of the game would be aware, who've had refereed about in which a fighter has gone into a coma and then has passed away. Now, there's actually been two I know of referees who refereed those fights who then have ended up taking their own lives because they feel so guilty that they didn't stop the fight sooner. Now, there were, as there is always when there's something as tragic as that happens in a sport, there was an inquest into the situation. His performance would have been judged. Should he have stepped in earlier? And usually, not all the time, but usually you find there are extenuating circumstances. And in the old days, it was very much about the weight loss on the day of the fight. You know, that they would do the weigh-in in the morning. Sensibly now, they make it a couple of days before or a day before so that they're not getting dehydrated before they go in the ring. So there were extenuating circumstances in most cases. But it's tragic that, again, an official who loves the sport that they're involved in is put in that position where they feel so bad that they, again, take the ultimate way out.
You know what? The other side of it is the responsibility we have as an individual towards our own, what you might call, mental health. And I wonder if people are being led down paths that they're not able to see other avenues to escape from it. In the sense, if you keep telling someone they're bloody brilliant all their life, they'll get to the point where suddenly come up against a roadblock. They might have serious struggles getting past this. Well, I'm bloody brilliant. Everybody tells me I'm bloody brilliant. Well, oh, I can't do this. Oh my God. I really can't. And that causes problems. Maybe if we stopped telling kids that they were bloody brilliant and told them, you're very good. Got a bit of work to do though.
100% agreement with me.
And even when, if you ask Steve Smith how good he was, are you as good as you could get? He'd tell you no.
Yeah, of course.
And that, I think sometimes the way we take our juniors into that next level sets them up for a mental failure.
Yeah, and that's why it's a whole nother talk for another day, but this is why I don't like these pathways, these development pathways, because you put these kids on a path where they think they're going on to be a superstar, they're going on to play professionally in a sport, and it might get a 16 or 17 and suddenly they fall off the pathway and they're going, what do I do now? Well, where do I go? And that's the same thing, and I really don't agree with this. I mean, I think I look back on my sporting career, and the best thing was honesty. It was a coach coming up to you and going, you're good at this, but you're not good at that. You need to work on that.
And let's face it, sport's supposed to be something we do for fun.
Enjoyment.
It's not supposed to be work. And I think sometimes when sport becomes work, it loses all of the meaning that it should have.
Loses its joy.
Some people are on the fence. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.